Now that's got it done. Well, we were looking for him on Monday, didn't happen. Saw him yesterday. So we've been looking forward to this, and Mark has been trying so hard for, I would guess, nearly 10 years to get us to come to Indianapolis. And here we are, and here he is. Mark?
Great to be with you. Sorry about Monday. If you heard me on Saturday or Friday, or even Sunday, as a matter of fact, I guess, you probably wouldn't recognize my voice now as being my real voice. Between the coughing and the frog in my throat, why, that was a little bit more than I thought you needed to hear, that I needed to share. So glad to be here today, though, and I'm really glad you guys are here, because Rita's right. I've gotten two or three proposals over the years to try to get you folks to come here. Finally, able to get it done, and so I'm excited to see some of you again and to meet some of you for the first time. I used to be involved with Christian Mission for the Blind, and I attended, I think there were four NCCBs. Yep. In 99, 2000, 2001, and 2002, I believe. Oh, 98, you're right. It was 98 was the first one. That was El Paso, wasn't it? Yes, yes. But then I remember going to a board meeting. I was elected as representative and walked into the boardroom and looked Reba in the eye, and she had this little twinkle. And I didn't know quite what to make of that, but then she announced at that board meeting that she was soon to be Mrs. Dunn. So that was kind of exciting for all of us, and we're sure glad to have Bobby as a part of the NCCB as well. What I'd like to try to do today is to cover the passage in Ruth, and then maybe to go up and pick some of the highlights of Joseph. There's so much in Joseph's life that is good for us. That we'll hit some of the high points at least. We won't be able to go into much detail. I'll try not to get into the afternoon session time. All right. The passage that Rick brought to us this morning was Ruth 1:16-18. And if you remember the story, Elimelech and his wife Naomi were facing a famine and went to the land of Moab. And when they got there, their two sons got married. And so they had two sons and two daughter-in-laws, or daughters-in-law, whichever is correct. But then Elimelech died, and the two sons died, so it was just the three ladies left. And finally, Naomi hears that the famine is over back home, so she decides she's going to head back among her people, her countrymen, her family. And so her daughters pack up and they get ready to go. Naomi says, no, you should stay here with your own folks. You know, you can go back home, you can leave me, I'll be all right. And they both say, no, we're in with you. But then she says again that, you know, you should just remain here. Picking up the story here in verse 13, it says, you should talk about, even if I had sons for you to marry, would you wait until they grow up to the age to be married? And she asked, would you remain unmarried for them? No, my daughters, it is more bitter for me than for you, because the Lord's hand has gone out against me. And at this, they wept again. Then Orpah, was her name then, of course, kissed her, that was the daughter's name, kissed her mother-in-law and kissed her goodbye, but Ruth clung to her. Look, said Naomi, your sister-in-law is going back to her people and her gods. Go back with her. And this is where we pick up what was read this morning. But Ruth replied, don't urge me to leave you or to turn back from you. Where you go, I will go, and where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. May the Lord deal with me, be it ever so severely, if anything but death separates you and me. When Naomi realized that Ruth was determined to go with her, she stopped urging her. Well, what can we learn, especially about commitment from Ruth and Naomi? I think there's a lot that we can see that would be helpful for us in our lives today. And so I want to try to find the practical application in each of these passages and in each of these stories that we're going to talk about this morning. In verse 16, Ruth replied, "Don't urge me to leave you or to turn back from you. Where you go, I will go, and where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die. There I will be buried." Several years ago, there was a Christian singer named Leon Petillo, and he had a great style. I liked listening to him, but he kind of got the nickname of Leon Repeato. Because he kept singing the same things over and over and over and over and over and over and over. And, you know, there are some people, that's what they like. They just it's just kind of like the spirit building in them as they sing it over and over again. And I'm not one of those people. I'm one of those folks that after about the third time, I say, "Okay, God, you heard me." And so I'll just let them finish singing the song. But here, Ruth says her commitment over and over again, but she says it in different ways. She says, "Don't urge me to go. Where you go, I will go." That's a great commitment. "Where you stay, I will stay." Well, another commitment there. "Your people will be my people." Okay? Have you ever moved to a different place, or when you get married, you come into a different family? You remember how that is? "And your God will be my God." Wow. There's conversion even involved in this. "Where you die, I will die. And there I will be buried." She said it and said it and said it again. And I think that is so important in our relationship with God that we continue to reaffirm our commitment to Him, to reaffirm the faith that we have in Him, the love that we have for Him, and the desire to serve that we have. And I think that's also important for us with our relationships with each other, that we don't neglect saying the things to one another that we need to say, the good things, the reassuring and reaffirming things. I heard about an old couple that were sitting on the porch rocking one evening, and the wife says to the husband, "You know, we've been married over 50 years now, and I don't know that you've said to me, 'I love you,' even once." And he said, "Well, you remember when I asked you to marry me? And she said, "Yeah." He said, "I told you I loved you." She said, "Yes." He said, "Nothing's changed." But you know, there are things that we do need to say over and over and over again. I've noticed, I have three children, three daughters. They're all grown up. Two of them are married. And the oldest daughter, her name is Heather. And she is just about to turn 30. And, yeah, it's hard to believe a young man like me. The sighted people are laughing at the color of my hair because of that. But anyway, I've noticed that she must have picked up something from me over all those years, because every time she almost walks out of the room from where her husband is, she says, "Love you, babe." And he says, "Love you." And I had supper with them last night, and I noticed it again. And I think, what a wonderful way that is to communicate. To not neglect, but to always remember to say the good things that we need to say to reaffirm the commitments that we make for each other. Because some of those commitments last a lifetime. This one that Ruth is saying here is that where you die, I will die, and there I'll be buried. May the Lord deal with me ever so severely, if anything but death separates you and me. She was willing, and here actually making, a lifetime commitment to her mother-in-law. Now, I've never been one to tell mother-in-law jokes because I have such a great mother-in-law. But you can just imagine what that can be for some people to realize that Ruth was making this kind of a commitment, not just to her own family by blood, but to her family by marriage, her mother-in-law. And so as she makes that commitment, she goes on to say, it goes on to tell us in the book here, that when Naomi realized that Ruth was determined to go with her, she stopped urging her. You know, sometimes we reach a point where it's okay just to say, all right, if you insist, that's what we'll do. Naomi was just convinced that the best thing for her daughter-in-laws would be for them to go back home and live among their own people and possibly find a husband there. And yet, when Ruth made such an ardent and decisive commitment to her, she said, she stopped urging her to go back. So the two women went on until they came to Bethlehem. When they arrived in Bethlehem, the whole town was stirred because of them, and the women exclaimed, "Can this be Naomi?" "Don't call me Naomi," she told them. "Call me Mara, because the Almighty has made my life very bitter. I went away full, but the Lord has brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi? The Lord has afflicted me. The Almighty has brought misfortune upon me." So Naomi returned from Moab, accompanied by Ruth the Moabitess, her daughter-in-law, arriving at Bethlehem as the barley harvest was beginning. Well, one of the things that we can understand is that God is in control. He was in control when Elimelech and Naomi first left their land. He was in control to bring food back to the land. He was in control as they came back home, to at least Naomi's home. But you remember that the name Naomi means struggles with God. It is struggle is the concept there. And so the name Mara then means bitter. And so she's kind of dealing with her emotions and picking a new name for herself, admitting that she's not really happy with what's going on so far. It's made her kind of bitter. But I want us to think for a minute about the value of family and then to ask you a question. Is God sneaky? Sometimes, Bob says. Anybody else? I'm afraid to answer it. Is God sneaky?
Sometimes it seems like it.
Yeah, sometimes it seems like it.
No.
I don't think he is.
I don't think so. Is it right?
No.
Okay.
Everything's going according to his plan.
Okay.
It all depends on your viewpoint. If you're looking at it from God's point of view, he's not sneaky. But if you're looking at it from our viewpoint, he might be.
Yeah.
Perspective. Well, God had been with them and brought them back, and they come back, and it says in chapter 2, now Naomi had a relative on her husband's side from the clan of Elimelech, a man of standing whose name was Boaz. And Ruth the Moabitess said to Naomi, "Let me go to the fields and pick up the leftover grain behind anyone in whose eyes I have found favor." Naomi said to her, "Go ahead, my daughter." So she went out and began to glean in the fields behind the harvesters. As it turned out, she found herself working in a field belonging to Boaz, who was from the clan of Elimelech. Just then, Boaz arrived from Bethlehem and greeted the harvesters. The Lord be with you. The Lord bless you, they called back. Boaz asked the foreman of his harvesters, whose young woman is that? The foreman replied, "She is the Moabitess who came back from Moab with Naomi. She said, 'Please let me glean and gather among the sheaves behind the harvesters.' She went into the field and has worked steadily from morning until now, except for a short rest in the shelter." So Boaz said to Ruth, "My daughter, listen to me. Don't go and glean in another field, and don't go away from here. Stay here with my servant girls. Watch the field where the men are harvesting and follow along after the girls. I have told the men not to touch you, and whenever you are thirsty, go and get a drink from the water jars the men have filled." At this, she bowed down with her face to the ground. She exclaimed, "Why have I found such favor in your eyes that you notice me, a foreigner?" Boaz replied, "I have been told all about you, what you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband. how you left your father and mother and your homeland and came to live with the people you did not know before. May the Lord repay you for what you have done. May you be richly rewarded by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge. The value of family many times goes far beyond just companionship or helpfulness or shared interests or things like that. Sometimes the value of family is that they help us stay close to God. My wife Betty and I just celebrated earlier in July on the 13th the 38th anniversary of our first date. Now, how many of you remember the first date you went on with your spouse? Anybody? All right, Bob's shaking his head. Yeah, that's it. See, those are good memories, aren't they? But we've been married 34 years now. But we had we dated almost 4 years before we got married. And all through high school then, I didn't have to worry about who I was going to take to the prom or anything. I already had all that worked out. But the value of family is also that they can help us stay close to God. Now, I know in my life, you know, my wife is a tremendous woman of faith and of commitment to the Lord. About a week ago, I think it was a week ago yesterday, it might have been on Monday, but a group from our church was getting ready to go on a missions trip. They're down in Honduras right now. And at the last, you know, few days before the trip, the only female adult sponsor that was going found out she was pregnant. And her doctor did not want her to leave the country. And so they were looking for, immediately they began looking for a woman who had a valid passport. Now, I had a valid passport, but I didn't meet the other qualification. But my wife, Betty, did. And she was willing, almost at the drop of a hat, to change her plans for the next few weeks because she was looking forward to being with us here and go where she needed to go and to do what she needed to do. And I got home last night and got on the computer, and the missionary down there has a blog on the computer, and so he had written a little bit about what they'd been doing, and then I saw this picture. And I went and clicked on the picture, and it enlarged it, and sure enough, there was my wife. And she must have been talking when the picture was taken because she had her hands up. So I don't know what she was saying, but she was smiling, so I was glad to see that. But God sometimes can work through our families and work through us to help our families. And in this case, God brought together these distant relatives because he had a purpose in mind for them. You know, but when I read this back up in verse 3, it says, as it turned out, she found herself working in a field belonging to Boaz. I guess you could call it a divine coincidence. You could call it, God's work that they didn't know about. You could call it God being sneaky. Sneaky's got a kind of a negative connotation to it, but so we won't say that. We'll say God was surprising. I like that word that we were using. God was ready to surprise them. And it's important for us to recognize God at work in our lives that way. Because if we skip down to verse 19, later on in the story, after Naomi has, or Ruth has gone back home after that first day of gleaning, her mother-in-law asks her, where did you glean today? Where did you work? Blessed be the man who took notice of you. Because she brought home far more than normally she could have expected to glean in a field in just one day. Then Ruth told her mother-in-law about the one at whose place she had been working. The name of the man I worked with today is Boaz, she said. The Lord bless him, Naomi said to her daughter-in-law. He has not stopped showing his kindness to the living and the dead. She added, that man is our close relative. He is one of our kinsmen redeemers. So God was working kind of behind the scenes. They may not have realized all that was in store for them, but at least they knew that they were in the right place at the right time, and that they had met the right person to take care of their immediate need for food. And so when we think about this story, there are some different attitudes that we can pick out that I think would be good for us to see and good for us to have, as a matter of fact. Well, the first one, the first attitude that I see in this particular part of the story is generosity. In verses 8 and 9, Boaz said to Ruth, "My daughter, listen to me. Don't go glean in another field, and don't go away from here. Stay here with my servant girls. Watch the field where the men are harvesting, and follow along after the girls. I have told the men not to touch you, and whenever you are thirsty, go and drink from the water jars the men have filled." So right off the bat, he's taking care of her physical needs. He's providing food for her to gather. He's protecting her, and he's even offering her water. But later on in the story, he goes a little bit further. Starting at verse 14, it says, "At mealtime, Boaz said to her, 'Come over here, have some bread, and dip it in the wine vinegar.' When she sat down with the harvesters, he offered her some roasted grain. She ate all she wanted and had some left over. As she got up to glean, Boaz gave orders to his men, 'Even if she gathers among the sheaves, don't embarrass her. Rather, pull out some stalks for her from the bundles and leave them for her to pick up, and don't rebuke her.' So Ruth gleaned in the field until evening. Then she threshed the barley that she had gathered and mounted it, and it amounted to an ephah. She carried it back to town, and her mother-in-law saw how much she had gathered. Ruth also brought out and gave her what she had left over after what she had eaten, when she had eaten enough." So not only do we see some generosity here from Boaz, but even Ruth when she gets back home. Not only is bringing back the grain, but even shares what's left over from her lunch with her mother-in-law. So wonderful attitude of generosity. I've kind of changed my perspective a little bit maybe on giving as I've grown up and grown in the Lord. It used to be that I knew that there was an example in the Bible of tithing, and so, you know, I would count my 10%. And I'd give it. And I just knew that that was part of what, you know, the pattern was. I know in the New Testament, God never requires that particular percentage, but it's a good example from the Old percent or the Old Testament, and the New Testament also tells us to give in proportion, so that's a great way to measure that, is in proportion, you know, how much should I give. But I've learned in recent years the joy of generosity. And until you experience it, I at least until I experienced it, I couldn't explain it. I don't know that I can still put it into words very well. But sometimes when you're young and you're just starting out, and especially as a young married couple, you know, we didn't have a whole lot in the way of things or money. I was in Bible college, and Betty was working at the college and taking some classes too. And I worked in a lumber yard for the first 3 years, I guess, that I was in school. And so, you know, there wasn't a whole lot of money around. There wasn't a lot of luxury in our life, but God was good, and He helped us, and we had a great time and thoroughly enjoyed ourselves serving Him and learning about Him. But it wasn't until I grew up a little more, spiritually probably as much as anything, and began to look for ways to give. Not ways to get out of giving, but ways to give. And I want to tell you that the joy of generosity is something that can really bless your life. Sometimes, you know, you go out to a restaurant and you get decent service and you figure out what the tip should be. And, you know, you can get a great amount of joy for an extra buck or two if you tip that waitress a little extra. You can get a great amount of joy when the offering plate comes by. The challenge I've heard before is to take out the biggest bill in your wallet and put it in. Unfortunately for me, that's usually not much, so I try to do a little better than that. But, you know, you can find great joy in giving. And certainly you can find great joy in giving more than just money. You know, giving your time, giving your efforts, giving your labor. There's lots of ways that you can give. And in this case, Boaz was giving food. He was providing not only for Ruth, but also for Naomi. Naomi was willing to give to share what she had. And yet, in order to have that attitude of generosity, there also has to be, I think, a great amount of trust in God. He's the one who promised us that if we give, he'll open up the gates of heaven or the windows of heaven. I can't remember exactly how Malachi says it. And pour out his blessings on us. So in Ruth and Naomi, we do kind of find that. Back up in verse 10, we read about Ruth. At this, she bowed down with her face to the ground. She exclaimed, "Why have I found such favor in your eyes that you notice me a foreigner?" She's saying this to Boaz. And I think this attitude of humility is one that we can't have if we're proud of it. Let me say it that way. You can't have an attitude of humility if you're proud of your humility. Humility is not thinking little of yourself, not thinking that you're little, not much. It's just not thinking of yourself. It's thinking of others. And then the third attitude I see in this story here is thankfulness. Certainly is important for us on more days than just Thanksgiving Day to be thankful. Verse 19, now this is after Ruth has come back to meet with Naomi. Her mother-in-law asked her, "Where did you glean today? Where did you work? Blessed be the man who took notice of you." Then Ruth told her mother-in-law about the one whose place she had been working. "The name of the man I worked with today is Boaz." "The Lord bless him," Naomi said. "He has not stopped showing his kindness to the living and the dead." She added, "That man is our close relative. He is one of our kinsmen redeemer." And don't you just love a story with a happy ending?
Yes.
You remember the rest of Ruth? How Boaz meets Ruth and how he goes through the process to redeem her as a kinsman redeemer, and how he takes Ruth and Naomi into his life. He marries Ruth, and the story ends up with the notice of the genealogy that comes after them. Clear in chapter 4 now, it says, "So Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife. Then he went to her, and the Lord enabled her to conceive and give birth to a son. The woman said to Naomi, 'Praise be to the Lord, who this day has not left you without a kinsman redeemer. May he become famous throughout Israel. He will renew your life and sustain you in your old age. For your daughter-in-law, who loves you and who is better to you than seven sons, has given him birth.' Then Naomi took the child and laid him in her lap and cared for him. The women living there said, 'Naomi has a son.' And they named him Obed, and he was the father of Jesse, the father of David." So you see, out of that story, a purpose emerges right at the end. That God had a plan for Naomi and for Ruth, and because of their willingness to be committed to one another, to appreciate the value of family, and to have the right attitudes in their hearts and lives, they became part of the lineage to David, which of course led on later to the lineage of our Lord. So it's a wonderful thing to realize that God can have a purpose in our life, even if it may take us a little while to figure it out. So let's be on the watch, and let's look and see how God can use us. In order to do that then, let's think about Joseph. The story of Joseph takes up several chapters in the book of Genesis, and in it, I think we can see some things that reinforce the attitudes that Ruth and Naomi had, and shows us some other ways that God has a purpose for our lives. Remember, the story of Joseph starts basically in Genesis 37 with Joseph kind of being the favorite son. And he gets treated a little bit different. Matter of fact, he brings on some of the scorn of his brothers because of something he did. You know, he brought a bad report to their father. Evidently, where they were out watching over the flocks, they must not have been doing their work right, or must not have been doing it at all. And so, you know, they're angry with him. They don't appreciate him. They want they don't want to be around him. They want to get rid of him. And so really, they do. They take him when their father Esau sends him out to check on them. The brothers all take him, throw him in a pit, and wait to see what to do with him. And when they see a caravan going by, they get this idea, hey, here's how we can get rid of him. We'll just sell him. You know, we don't have to hurt him. We'll just send him away. And so they do. They make arrangements with the caravan that's on its way to Egypt, and they sell him. They take his coat of many colors, and they kill a goat, and they take the blood and spread it on the coat, and they take the coat back to their father, and they say, you know, Joseph must be dead. You know, we don't know what happened to him or where he is. And so Joseph then goes on into Egypt, and this is where we want to pick up the story. In chapter 39 of Genesis. Now when Joseph had been taken down to Egypt, Potiphar, an Egyptian, who was one of Pharaoh's officials, the captain of the guard, brought him from the Ishmaelites who had taken him there. The Lord was with Joseph, and he prospered, and he lived in the house of his Egyptian master. When his master saw that the Lord was with him, and that the Lord gave him success in everything he did, Joseph found favor in his eyes, and became his attendant. Potiphar put him in charge of his household, and he entrusted to his care everything he owned. From the time he put him in charge of his household and of all that he owned, the Lord blessed the household of the Egyptian because of Joseph. The blessing of the Lord was on everything Potiphar had, both in the house and in the field. So he left in Joseph's care everything he had with Joseph in charge. He did not concern himself with anything except the food he ate. Boy, you talk about some trust. Potiphar just kind of turns over the reins to Joseph and gives him complete control. So the only thing Potiphar worries about is, what am I going to have for dinner? Wouldn't that make life simple that you could let somebody do everything else for you and all you had to worry about was what you were going to have for dinner? Well, we find out, though, that when Joseph was there, sold into slavery in a foreign land, away from his family, that God was still with him. It is so important for us, so vital for us to remember that God is with us. It's easy sometimes to forget or to be in doubt, to just not be sure that God is really there. We just don't see him working or we can't sense him around us. But he's there. His promise is to never leave us or forsake us. And so we know that he's there, and we just need to completely trust him in that. Hebrews chapter 13, beginning of verse 4, says, because God has said, never will I leave you, never will I forsake you. So we say with confidence, the Lord is my helper. I will not be afraid. What can man do to me? Well, what can man do to us? Well, man can do a lot to us. And there are times when we may not sense God's presence or his protection, or we may just be doubting a little bit. The first missions trip I ever took was to Jamaica. And I went with another church, and I realized that the folks who had planned that missions trip knew a lot about planning missions trip. Because when we left Indianapolis in January, it was 8 degrees, and there were 4 inches of sleet on the ground. It was those little ice balls, and driving through them was like trying to drive through sand. But when we stepped out of the airplane in Montego Bay, I don't know what the temperature was, but I was glad the breeze was blowing, and we got to go swimming in the ocean that evening. That's the way to plan a missions trip. But unfortunately, all did not go as smooth. We were down there for about 2 weeks, and in the Sunday that we were there, about in the middle of that, we'd been to church, and there was a young man in the church who was going to show us the way to travel down to this place called Alligator Bay. Didn't sound like a great place to me to swim, but that's why we were going there, to swim. And there's a little bay in the ocean, you know, and so he rode with us down from this town called Top Hill, and we went down there, we swam, and, you know, the waves were pretty high, really. It was a little bit concerning, and all of a sudden, some of the kids started yelling. And unfortunately, this young man had been out a little bit too far and was pulled under by the undertow and was not seen again that day, at least. And so the police were called, and, you know, they came down, and basically all I did was looked around and, you know, said, well, I guess he must be gone. I don't see him, and went back to make his report. But by the time all that had happened and we waited for the police and we were, you know, released to go, it was almost dark. And so we headed back up towards the town because we were going to go back through the town and then get back to the mission house in Kingston. And we went around the curve in the road, and there were all these cars parked, and there were people outside. And by the tone of their voices and the way they were speaking loudly and the gestures, and, you know, they were pretty agitated. They were pretty upset. And so we sat there in the van. We didn't get out, but we weren't sure what was going on. But I have to admit, I thought ran through my mind, I wonder if this is going to be my last missionary trip. You know, God, I don't know what you have in mind here, but I tell you what I'd like. And so we, you know, eventually then the crowd kind of dispersed, and we went on back up into the town and stopped off at the preacher's house and got ready to go again. I was sitting in the van, and this older woman came by, and she was just, you know, shaking her fist at the van we were in, and I really couldn't catch what she was saying. She was very aggravated, but I sure got the impression that she wasn't happy with us, that she thought it was our fault that this young man had died. He'd ridden down with us. The reason he went was to show us the way. And once again, there the crowd had gathered, and we took off and finally got away and went back to the mission. And while we were driving away, I just happened to mention to the missionary lady, her name was Adele, you know, I wasn't sure what was going to happen back there. She said, what do you mean? And I told her about Paul, the boy's grandmother coming by the van. She said, oh, I don't think it would have been any problem at all, you know. Nobody said anything, and, you know, we got out okay. Well, the next morning, she got a phone call, was talking to the preacher in the town, you know, trying to work out how maybe the mission could help the family in their time of loss and all those things. And sure enough, she came back and said, I didn't realize what was really going on there. I didn't catch it. And sometimes we don't really lose our faith. We may not even doubt God, but there are those times of uncertainty. And that was just for a few minutes, a couple of different times in a day. Think about Joseph. His life and his story here give us practically a whole sermon series that we could do on how to handle things in life. Like how to handle jealousy. His brothers were jealous of him, is why they sold him away. Or how to handle discouragement. How to handle rejection. And then this story goes on to talk about Potiphar's wife. It says, now Joseph was well-built and handsome, and after a while, his master's wife took notice of Joseph and said, come to bed with me. But he refused. With me in charge, he told her, my master does not concern himself with anything in the house. Everything he owns, he has entrusted to my care. No one is greater in this house than I am. My master has withheld nothing from me except you, because you are his wife. How then could I do such a wicked thing and sin against God? And though she spoke to Joseph day after day, he refused to go to bed with her or even be with her. One day, he went into the house to attend to his duties, and none of the household servants was inside. She called him by his cloak and said, come to bed with me. But he left his cloak in her hand and ran out of the house. When she saw that he had left his cloak in her hand and had run, run out of the house, she called her household servants. Look, she said to them, this Hebrew has been brought to us to make sport of us. He came in here to sleep with me, but I screamed. When he heard me scream for help, he left his cloak beside me and ran out of the house. She kept his cloak beside her until the master came home. Then she told him this story. That Hebrew slave you brought came to me to make sport of me, but as soon as I screamed for help, he left his cloak beside me and ran out of the house. When his master heard this story, the story his wife told him, saying, "This is how your slave treated me," he burned with anger. Joseph's master took him and put him in prison, the place where the king's prisoners were confined. Joseph shows us that, unfortunately, even in the worst circumstances, sometimes things can get even worse through no fault of his own. But he gives us a great example here in how to handle temptation. There are several things that he shows us here that remind us that the devil is real, and he tempts us, and he wants us to sin, just like Peter said in 1 Peter chapter 5. Be self-controlled and alert. Your enemy, the devil, prowls about like a roaring lion looking for someone to devour. Now, that's a verse that's pretty familiar to all of us. But too often, I leave out this next verse. It says, resist him, standing firm in the faith, because you know that your brothers throughout the world are under the same kind of suffering. See, that's kind of the opposite reaction that Joseph had. Joseph ran. Peter told us to stand firm. How do we reconcile those two things? Well, we might look in James chapter 4. It says, submit yourselves then to God. Resist the devil and he will flee from you. Come near to God and he will come near to you. Wash your hands, you sinners, and purify your hearts, you double-minded. One of the things that we have to remember, if we're going to try to stand firm against the devil, is that we have to stand with God. Alone, we don't have enough strength, we don't have enough endurance, we don't have enough power to withstand the onslaught of Satan, but with God, we have overcome. He has overcome, and we get that power available to us. We can also remember what Paul wrote in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, where he says, no temptation has seized you except that what is common to man. And God is faithful. He will not let you be tempted beyond what you can bear. But when you are tempted, he will provide a way out so that you can stand up under it. So you see, even if we're going to stand firm against Satan, and even if we're going to stand with God, sometimes we need a way out. We need to be able to flee, to run, to get away. Paul wrote to Timothy in 1 Timothy 6:11 to flee from all this, from pride and materialism and sexual immorality. In 1 Corinthians 6, 18 and 20, through 20, again, Paul writes to flee from sexual immorality. The senior minister at our church told a story not too long ago about a friend of his, single guy, Christian, did work around houses, painting in particular, and he went to this one house, and he was getting ready to start his painting job. It was down in the basement of this big house. And so the lady that lived there was home, so she went down, and she was talking to him as he was setting up his equipment. And he started to work, and, you know, he noticed the conversation was kind of going in an odd direction. And he said, really, he was embarrassed later. It took him so long to figure out what was going on. But finally, he understood that this lady was trying to get him upstairs into the bedroom. And as soon as he figured that out, he just started stumbling and mumbling and grabbing his equipment as fast as he could. And he said, I'm sorry, I don't accept tips. he was so nervous and so upset and so startled by all this. That's the only thing he could think of to say. God provided a way out. Because God is with us. He'll never leave us or forsake us. Well, the story of Joseph kind of goes on. Let's just see if we can hit a few of the high points later on. He's in jail there. What happens when he gets in jail? Anybody remember this time?
Fellow jail people.
Yes.
One is the butcher and one is the baker. A cupbearer and the baker.
Cupbearer and the baker, that's right. And they have dreams. They have these weird dreams. They don't know what these dreams mean. And so Joseph gives them the interpretation of the dreams.
Yeah.
So the cupbearer, he says, in 3 days you're going to be restored to your position. to the baker. He says, in 3 days, you're going to be killed. And as they leave the prison 3 days later, he says, hey, remember me. You know, remember what I did there. And, of course, when they get out of prison, they don't remember. They go on, about, well, the cupbearer goes about his life, and the baker loses his. So it goes on quite a while, and finally, Pharaoh starts having these weird dreams. And he doesn't know what the meaning is, and so he goes to his astrologers and his wise men, and nobody can come up with the interpretation for the dreams. And finally, the cupbearer says, oh, hey, guess what? I remember. I met this guy down in the prison that he interpreted the dreams for us, and they came true exactly like he said. So they brought him out, cleaned him up before they brought him into the presence of the king, and he told him the interpretations of the dream. And he went a little further than that. He made a recommendation. He said, you need to find somebody, a good manager, who can prepare for this coming famine. And you need to set aside, you know, have everybody set aside, or I guess form it as almost a tax, so that we can set aside enough grain to get us through those lean years. And Pharaoh was smart enough to look for somebody who had that kind of skill and ability, and it was Joseph, of course. And so he puts Joseph in charge, and one of the things that I think is helpful for us to realize is that when things don't go the way we planned, that doesn't necessarily mean that we're not in God's will. What it may mean is that we just don't understand completely His plan for us. And sometimes it just takes time for that plan to unfold as God wants it to unfold. And in the meantime, though, just keep serving Him. Use whatever gifts you have and abilities and whatever fits your personality and your heart and your passion and whatever experiences you've had, use them to help others and to serve God. And that's what Joseph did while he was in prison. Because he got put in charge of everything in the prison, he gets brought out to the king, put in charge of the whole kingdom. Because he stayed with God, and he knew that God stayed with him. And then, of course, you remember the story, I hope, that the famine comes just as the dreams had predicted and just as Joseph had interpreted. And so that even back in the land of his family, in Canaan, the famine is there. So they send for food, and you know, Joseph gets reunited with his family, but they don't recognize him at first. He reveals himself to them, and finally the whole family moves in, and the nation then basically resettles in Egypt and stays there until the time of the Exodus. So Joseph dealt with all kinds of different things in his life. He dealt with favoritism, he dealt with jealousy, he dealt with abandonment, he dealt with temptation, all these things he dealt with can be an example for us today as we have to deal with those same kinds of things today. And so when we read these stories, let's don't just read them as good literature, although they are, or exciting stories, although some of them are. Let's realize that these were real people that lived, served, pleased God, and are an example for us today. Tomorrow, we'll finish up with the story of Naaman, 2 Kings. One of my favorite Bible stories of all time, with some good, good practical application for us today. Thank you.
Well, let's let everybody go to lunch and